Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is the L.A. Steel Show. And tonight we're going to continue with some of the work from Manly Hall, Manly P. Hall. And I had mentioned this in the last show that we did on this last Thursday. Man, I tell you, the weeks go by fast. But, excuse me. Manly Hall, for those of you who are just joining us, Manly Hall was actually he was a mystic and a Mason and a psychologist by 27 had written The Secret Knowledge of the Ages. And he was quite an intuitive. And there's a lot to be said about him. He is a 33-degree Mason and whatnot, and a man of 8,000 lectures and so on. But I'm taking this slowly as I'm reading this. And I have many, many of his essays. I really don't even know how many of them there are. I probably have about 100 of his essays, not essays, but lectures, selected lectures that were given to me by George Dixon. And I really appreciate them, but it's been quite a journey here the last few weeks that I've been involved with reading these. And tonight I'm going to attempt to read The 10 Regions on the Afterlife, according to the teachings of Northern Buddhism. This is by Manly P. Hall. This is a lecture of December 1st, 1968, is when he gave this lecture. And we're going to begin here. Nearly every religion in the world has had some concept of punishment after death, also of reward after death, for those who have led exceptionally praiseworthy lives. For the most part, from the general books on the subject, it would seem, however, that the number of the rewarded is considerably smaller than the number of the punished. Therefore, more persons probably have walked the straight and narrow from fear of damnation than from hope of heaven. Actually, it is very difficult, philosophically, to rationalize this entire idea. In the first place, it is undoubtedly true that the average person lives very close to his allotment of strength and integrity. Life is very difficult for many people, and in addition to the normal responsibilities of life, there have been a number of theological hazards introduced so that a virtuous life by itself would not seem sufficient to assure a fortunate condition in the after-death state. With various understandings and misunderstandings on the subject, the whole theory has fallen into a general disrepute. Today, it is very seldom that we hear a Christian minister or a member of any other religious group heavily emphasizing the problems of punishment after death. The development in astronomy and physics in general, and many other changes in human psychology, have all tended to cause the average person to live through the years of his life inspired by his hopes rather than discouraged by his fears. There are not many persons alive who expect extraordinary torture beyond the grave. We simply do not think this way any longer, and many sects that not long ago used the idea of after-death punishment in an effort to curb human delinquency have found that the results were not particularly successful. Some years ago, I visited the Leper Temple in Peking. It was a rather terrible place then in many ways. Leprosy, at least when I was there, was not segregated, and sufferers in various stages of the ailment had gone to this temple of the universe to die. The temple itself was also ornamented with the most gruesome representations in which all the possible punishments for the delinquencies of men were displayed in life-size models. The general impression was one of the chamber of horrors in a waxworks. Actually, however, no one seemed to care much about these models. Those who went there in their last days did not appear to be especially discouraged by these images, and I was told that others appear to be especially told that other sets of similar figures existed in the Peking area, and that a number of these areas were favorite picnic resorts. So even where life-size figures in the most gruesome conditions of the after-death state were exhibited, even the more superstitious Chinese were not very greatly moved. To them, these likenesses were meaningless. If we wonder just exactly what the original idea for these figures may have been, perhaps we can get a clear insight on this problem from the teachings of certain schools of Buddhist thought than from any other source. I do not know of any other group of religion or religion that has so systematically attempted to rationalize the problem of the after-death state as Buddhism. The tendency here is simply to assume that it is pleasant or rewarding, and that if, by some extraordinary circumstances, punishment is necessary, it is a very kindly and benign type of chastisement that is given. Now, that in itself I find to be fascinating, since everybody knows about the hell and brimstone that we were taught as kids. That's if you were born when we were born, or I was born. And the Nichiren sect of Buddhism has a mandala, or meditation figure, that is quite interesting, and which illustrates the Buddhistic approach to the problem of the after-death state. It is a circle divided into 10 compartments by radical lines. In the center of this circle is a Chinese glyph, which can be translated as meaning mind. And, however, as many of these words have more than one meaning, when the old glyphs are employed, it can also be interpreted to mean soul, or the psychic nature of the individual. The mind, or soul, therefore, forms the axis upon which the mystery of the 10 worlds moves, and turning like the famous wheel of embodiment. A symbolical and psychological interpretation is the only way in which the Buddhists could possibly approach the problem, yet it is admitted that the art of many Buddhist schools is quite literal as far as representations of the tortures of lost souls is concerned. We find just as many rather gruesome and lurid figures in the old northern Buddhist system as we find in many other regions. In the southern Buddhist system, we have even more austere and literal interpretations of punishment after death. Therefore, it is rather interesting that, at least philosophically, this symbol of the 10 regions should move on a central axis of the mind. The Buddhist is forced to assume that the 10 states of existence are mental phenomenon. This is the only way that he can be true to the teaching of Gautama Buddha. Because the Buddha pointed out that the universe itself is merely an interpretation on the part of man. All conditions pertaining to man originate within him as mental phenomenon, and therefore heaven and hell are states of mind. We can use all kinds of lurid and decorative pictures to represent these states, but in each instance, the picture is symbolical of an inner state of human consciousness. This is not so different from certain interpretations of the mysterious universe of Dante. All the regions and realms of the afterlife and purgatorial and paradisal, the Buddhists would accept as symbols of condition within men's minds. The mysterious ghosts of the afterlife could actually be interpretations by the individual of conditions within himself, his own thoughts, his own mental and psychic nature. If we are willing to accept, therefore, that the 10 regions are psychological, then these reasons are not places that we go to after we die, nor are they necessarily places from which we come when we are born. They are simply the 10 levels of our own consciousness by means of which we make heaven and hell out of any condition in which we find ourselves. This concept places punishment and reward firmly upon the sattvic or mental focus of the individual. It makes him responsible for his own heavens and hells. It causes him to live in a series of levels or conditions that represent the individual's own natural faith. So hell is what we make it, and hell is what we make it, and heaven is what we make it. And that's what the Buddhists believe. And the Tibetans divide it, and we don't go to either place. We live it in this life or in the next life as we're reincarnated. The Tibetans divide their universe into 6 departments instead of 10 because in their systemization, they do not include any state above that of the Deva or angelic kingdom. In Japan and China, however, the wheel was enlarged to include higher forms of consciousness and therefore extra departments. 4 in number were added. These extra compartments represent degrees of enlightenment, whereas the lower 6 departments largely have to do with conditions of benightness. In the northern system, it is clearly emphasized that Buddha himself is a state of mind. Zen makes this point also, but none of us, Buddhists and non-Buddhists, actually have any idea whatever about Buddha as a person. We do not know very much about him historically. We know less about him as an experience of consciousness. Therefore, regardless of whether we are Buddhists or Christians, the same problem bears. The Christ we know is the Christ in us. Christ to us is our own interpretation and our own individual expression of the Christ mystery. We are not walking the shores of Galilee 2,000 years ago. Christ is a person, a man who was known to his original apostles. We cannot know. All we can know is our interpretation, our glorification, and our deification of someone whom we greatly respect and admire, but who actually we have not known. The same is true in Buddhist philosophy. The Buddha, who walked the road to India 25 centuries ago, exists for us only as a man in our own consciousness. He exists to us in the art of Buddhist nations from which we have derived the likenesses of the teacher, and he exists for us in the symbolism that has been associated with him by the various schools of Buddhist thought. Therefore, technically, the Buddha of human appreciation today is one of the levels of mental phenomenon. It is a level which we ourselves attempt to interpret, understand, or appreciate, a fact that can only exist now inside ourselves. It is rather important that also very honest to assume that all the states of the universe are conditions of our own nature. By this simple key, we unlock practically every theology and world has ever known. And here is the key to the mysterious shadowlands of the Greeks and Latins. Here is the key to the mysterious underworlds of Egypt. Everywhere we turn, we find symbols of stratified universe, a universe which, strangely enough, in Buddhism, is divided in its final state into 33 subdivisions, each representing levels or years of spiritual growth. This number is also sacred in Christianity. For our purposes, let us take one of these interesting symbolic wheels or symbols to be found in the schools of Northern Buddhism and try to understand a little of its essential significance psychologically. I think that in so doing, we will be of some value in helping the average person to orient his own way of life with a certain amount of understanding and with greater insight than is generally apparent. If it is true, as Buddhism has always affirmed, that life is very largely a matter of suffering, then suffering is, in turn, must be a mental attitude. It must be a condition of the mind arising from acceptances and rejections of phenomena. Suffering must be the effect of cause which have arisen in the mind. Suffering must be memory or the continuance of patterns which in themselves are no longer useful. Suffering must have to do with strong action producing its own natural karmic results. And the sequence of the pain and the perpetuation of negative karma constitute the lower region of the Buddhist wheel of life. The lowest of the 10 conditions or compartments of life is approximately equivalent to our Christian concept of hell. It is a place of strange and terrible punishments. To the Buddhist, this place of terrible punishment simply represents the level of consciousness on which the individual suffers without knowing why he suffers. This is considered the most terrible of all punishments. The great and terrible suffering is to suffer without knowing that we are the cause of our own suffering. Without knowing the cause of suffering, we curse the very heavens that fashioned it. We suffer strange and terrible catastrophes with no sense of justice. This reminds me of the book of Job, actually. And this condition is considered the lowest level in Buddhist system, because most people do not know why pain is visited upon them. Life, instead of just of being just, appears as injustice, and such individuals do not realize that the conditions they endure are the results of consequences they set in motion. The individual who sees no solution and no answer and no reasonable explanation for himself and yet must go through the strange cycle of pain and sorrow, misery and death, this individual is in a comparatively hopeless condition. He has no security, no strength, no integrity within himself. He must depend upon the eternal ministry of the universe to bring him finally to the enlightenment which he so desperately needs. In Mahayana Buddhism, the Bodhisattva Avalokitesvara, or Kanon, C-A-N-N-O-N, is represented in seven forms. Of these forms, one is called the Senju Kanon, or the Kanon of a Thousand Arms and Eyes. This particular version of the Kanon is placed in the mandala, or diagram, in the lower region. Kanon, K-A-N-N-O-N, is the compassionate Lord of infinite helpfulness, standing forever in the region of absolute ignorance. We have in this symbolism the infinite compassion of life, which, whether we are aware of it or not, continues to play its redeeming part. In this strange realm in which there is no honesty that redeeming that man can comprehend, man locks himself against his own faults and produces one of the most unfortunate of all situations, the situation of absolute negative rationalization. And the individual is continually attempting to prove that he is faultless, and therefore his punishment is a strange dishonesty and fate. This is why this lower realm is shown with figures and torture. Among those who are supposedly subjected to this realm, according to the old Chinese and Japanese Buddhists, are religious teachers who teach false doctrines, or public officials who use for their own benefit public funds, and any man who destroys a book. In the old drawings, such individuals are portrayed as being surrounded with flames. Now it is obvious that none of these individuals, however gross their crime, really deserve this eternal punishment. These flames are in some mysterious way symbols of conscience. They are symbols of the individual being forced to live with his own misdeeds, whether he realizes the magnitude of them or not. In his own misdeeds, in ignorance, pain, silence, and suffering, he must live with his former misdeeds, with a deep, mysterious pain of conscience. He must live with his present misdeeds. In a universe in which misdeeds are almost universal, past or present, the future seems strangely dark and hopeless. In this lower region, we have the mental identification of the individual. In a state of comparative hopelessness, helplessness, rebellion, and pain, this is the lowest realm of the wheel, and realm which represents the lowest point of human interpretation of the significance of self. The next realm is called the region of the hungry ghosts. Here, strange creatures, semi-human in shape, but lurid, pale, mysterious, and deformed, wander around in a realm in which all food turns into rock, all water turns into iron, and where every effort at nourishment strangely fails. The answer to this region is to be found in Christian scriptures when Jesus tells the woman at the well, that those who drink of the waters of everlastingness shall thirst no more. The ghosts in this realm are those, as the word hungry would imply, who lived in this world in the pale ghostliness of human appetite and desire. These are the individuals who lived throughout life only for the gratification of their own appetites, emotions, and instincts. They are the ones who lived only to satisfy the physical demands of their body, of their own egos. They are the ones to whom success meant accumulation of material things. They were the ones who were ever seeking after power. They are the ones who lived entirely on the level of gratification of senses and emotions. Release from this kind of hunger is one of the most painful and difficult lessons to be learned. For those who try to satisfy these hungers will fail. Such individuals see their achievements turn into iron and stone, and in every quest for duels, see their achievements for happiness ends in pain. The ghosts of this region are forever hungry, forever thirsty. They live in a realm in which there are no securities, no ultimate fulfillments, and no final satisfaction. The hungry ones are defined as those who grasp. They are the ones who are jealous of the possessions of others. They are the ones who are envious and those who are constantly seeking to accumulate for themselves. They are all such individuals for whom physical gratification is of primary importance. For these comforts, an individual will compromise his integrities, his values, and his principles. Our mortal world can be largely symbolized as such a ghost land of hungry spirits. Everywhere we turn, men are hungry. Hungry for gain, hungry for luxury, hungry for comparative excellence, hungry for larger homes and better cars, demanding forever. Such individuals attempt to live upon the food of possessions. The individual who seeks fulfillment for his eternal yearnings is less than himself. Have I got that right? An individual who seeks fulfillment for his eternal yearnings by the amassment of material things is the hungry ghost. Incidentally, this realm is fairly well populated. We all know people who are already in this strange realm. I rather suspect that this realm cannot be anywhere but here. If, for instance, one of these individuals passes on, he does not go into some strange purgatory of ghosts and mysteries. According to Buddhism, he simply continues to be a hungry ghost. It may take hundreds of embodiments to escape from this net of matter, but as long as the individual is ambitious, as long as he will sacrifice honor for gold, so long he will suffer, so long he will strive desperately for happiness and find forever disillusionment. And impoverished by his own possessions, he drifts to the grave, disillusioned and heartbroken, losing his true friends and the respect and affection of his family. The third realm, of course, the realm of the animals. Some Buddhists have maintained that those who live on animalistic levels in this life, living the life of an animal, although in human form, may by transmigration be reborn as animals. However, the more advanced Buddhist does not believe this. In the northern school, where one accepts these things as mental phenomenon, only the problem of being reborn as an animal is also a mental attitude, not a factual thing. The world of the animals represents that level on which the individual's lives without enlightenment The world of animals represents that level on which the individual lives without enlightened conduct. It is that world on which man is endowed with perceptions, faculties, and powers, but does not develop them. It is man living below his own light and below his own level. The animal is defined as that being who has a full psychophysical and emotional nature, but who has not placed active consciousness at the summit of his vehicles. By evolution, this phase of individualism, individual, individual here, not taking advantage of his own humanity, lives below the level of general humanity. Here we find the individual has the herding instinct. Here we find the individual who lives and dies without any clear definition of purpose. The animal to the Buddhist represents the being who makes no preparation for a nobler future. His life does not lead to any particular direction. And such an individual sees no reason for being other than entirely sees no reason for being other than entirely human. He lives below his true level because he has within himself no urge to true enlightenment. He has not found a path and has not recognized his own eternity. He does not realize that upon the level of his own action must the world grow and develop. Such a person does not sense the difference between the animal kingdom and a human way of life. And to the Buddhist, the animal represents any creature who is not taking advantage of its available measure of enlightenment. Man, there are so many people out there like that. There are so many people like that that don't even understand that there is an enlightenment or any a path to it. It has been said in ordinary philosophical and scientific thinking that if animals had the same intelligence that man has, they would have long age conquered the world and would have taken it away from human beings. Because they do not have a realization of themselves, because they do not know their own potential, man, animal-like beings do not plan or organize a future for themselves. They live only in the present, only in the immediate, and for lack of a long-range purpose, the immediate loses its value. Therefore, the human being on this level suffers without gaining what suffering might have meant to him. The person, for example, who goes through life with one misfortune after another and never realizes the reasons for them, who simply goes on after another and never realizes, or who simply goes on making the same mistakes inevitably and eternally, becoming no wiser at the end of many repetitions of the same disaster, might be regarded as being in the purgatorial of the animals. This is a being who suffers without growing by suffering. A being without the continuity of consciousness, which enables him to strengthen the relationship between cause and effect. A relationship which gives him the right to plan an intelligent future and allows to build the security he needs. Failing individual is a beast in a world of men. Wherever the animal nature dominates, man is less than himself. Wherever man fails to dream, he becomes the victim of the nightmare of his own benightedness. To be born, according to the Buddhists, back into the animal life, or to be reborn, as Pythagoras pointed out, through the bodies of the holy animals, simply means to be born again in a world of unpurposed existence and to live in a world in which we say, I am born, but I know not why. I live, but I do not know why. I die, but I do not know why. And I pass to some other state, and I do not know where. To leave these questions in this state and in this condition is to bring certain inevitable suffering upon oneself. The individual with this shortcoming in his own consciousness loses a great opportunity for happiness. He remains as he must, always remain miserable and disillusioned and hurt, simply because he does not understand. Thus we have a purgatorial that is less than the perdition below, but not as good as what might be found above. On the next level of the great wheel, we find mankind in itself. This is the level which, according to the Buddhists of both schools, in the most desirable, is the most desirable. This is that part of the wheel of life in which the human being, born with his own full humanity is best equipped to face the problems and the challenges of life. The Buddhist definition of a human being is one whose mind is dedicated to the solution of ignorance. A being whose life is concerned primarily with the perfection of those aspects and attributes by means of which suffering is brought to an end. The individual who is ruled by the best within himself, obeys the best of society, is dedicated to the highest and best and most constructive pursuits, who lives to be a service to all and a menace to none, such an individual is actually a human being. A human being is one in whom the spirit of violence has ceased, one who solves problems with inner consciousness, one whose patience is great, one whose wisdom is equivalent to his own daily being, and one who accepts responsibilities without evasion. The human being is the one who has gradually cultivated and cultured his own faculties and powers until there is open to him a path to greater achievement, a path that leads upwards through genius to enlightenment. It is a very simple, very natural, but very dedicated. It has nothing to do. It is a very simple, very natural, and very dedicated way of life. It has nothing to do with the particular mental attainment of the individual in terms of intellectualism. It is the measure of basic integrity of the individual. The truly human being has a simple, natural dedication of life to the good. He recognizes the importance of learning. He gives thoughtful acceptance of experience. He is not in rebellion or revolution against the great laws under which we must live. The truly human being honors his neighbors, guards his world, and venerates his creator. In this way, he fulfills his true humanity. According to Buddhism, this is the most fortunate state into which the human being can be born, for it is from this state that higher conditions can be achieved. But there is no way of attaining to the higher unless the individual is first able to exist in the human state. This means the state of enlightenment, which is proper and normal to his level. To some Buddhists, karma meant that if men were good, they would be assured of having a human body in their next life. Actually, this is not the understanding of the most enlightened Buddhists. Their understanding was that we are all going to have a human body anyway. It wasn't that body that was important. It was whether a human being was being embodied. Whether a human being was embodied depended on past effort. If the individual had attained the level of human being, he would be so embodied. If he had not, he would then be embodied in one of the lower levels of psychic integration, which we mentioned, the animal or worse, the poor guy who is being tortured in life and doesn't have a clue why. The next level, which the Buddhists understood, and one which I think is quite interesting, is what is called the world of the devas, or the asuras. This is perhaps one of the most unique and interesting aspects of Buddhism, for in this region, the region of the deva, we find the Buddhist interpretation, more or less, of all other religious systems. We find in the realm of the deva the level of which of what may be termed the gods. Buddhism does not have any concept of God as we know it. That is, Buddhism does not postulate an absolute autocrat at the source of life. Buddhism does not postulate Buddhism does not assume that the gods of the various pantheons of the world are absolute beings. It rather assumes that the sphere of the gods is also a state of mind, and that Zeus or any of the other divinities is a being in the mind which affirms the belief in godhood. Through long karmic experience, Such beings have raised themselves to the various degrees of authority, but they are not really deities at all, except as they affirm themselves to be deities. In India, these beings are called devas, while in Japan they are called asuras. And the word deva does not necessarily mean evil spirit, as is sometimes suggested. How shall we define the Deva kingdom as the Buddhists understand it? It is not the Devic kingdom of Hinduism or Brahmaism. The Deva plane, according to Buddhism, while admitted to be a state of mind, nevertheless belongs to those beings who have achieved great authority. The ruler of a nation might be considered a Deva. The head of a great corporation would be a Deva. Whatever the being is who says, I have achieved, I am not only a person of great leadership, but I am necessary to the salvation of other people, such a being is a deva. If a congressman or justice assumes such authority, he would be a deva. And Buddhism points out that when the individual achieves a position of authority, he is in a very sensitive condition psychologically. It is almost impossible to be in a position of authority without the entry of egotism. The moment we believe ourselves to be necessary, according to Buddhism, we become completely unnecessary. Arrogance destroys our psychic nature. That explains politics, doesn't it? And the patriot who lives and dies unselfishly for his country, the great scientist who perhaps becomes a victim of his own experiments in order to advance the health of others, the conscientious and dedicated missionary who goes forth convinced that he must try to help and serve people, or the enlightened leader of all kinds of organizations, enlightened in the sense of really believing that he is doing a necessary job, such individuals, according to Buddhism, provide leadership on what might be termed the Deva level, or the abode of the Tenno. In the symbolism of this Deva state, the Buddhists make use of Hindu symbolism of Mount Meru, or Mount Simuru, and assumes that at the source of existence are great deities and great beings. Such beings are great because of their superior dedication, and great because of beings, or rather, and great because of their belief in their own importance and inevitability. Such individuals then could be the head of great corporations, or the Indian god Brahma. To the Buddhist, the god Brahma is a kind of chairman of the board of directors for the universe. He is an able and remarkable being. An entity who through evolution has passed through growth and unfoldment and has come to the attainment of temporal authority in life. Brahma has earned the right to be the leader of some class of beings. Another being who has gained the right to certain leadership in the world is Shiva, and likewise Indira, known in Japan as Tai Shakuten. Indra is a favorite god among Buddhists. He was one of the Vedic gods of the wind, but in Buddhism he became one of the defenders of the faith. In summary, what we have a hierarchy of deities of Vedic, Hindu, and other origins who have now become, you might say, the defenders of Buddhism in the invisible universe of things. They represent virtue that has attained great spiritual responsibility, but this spiritual responsibility is still within the mysterious realm of illusion. Brahma is an illusionary state. He may believe that he has actually created the universe, and others may worship him because they believe he has created the universe. His belief, however, is not of primary importance. Of primary importance is what he intends to do with the universe he thinks he has created. Like the head of a great company who says, I built this company from nothing. Brahma did and did not create the universe. He could never have done it alone. Even the corporation has the dedicated labor of many people, like the generalissimo in the army, who is given credit for the victory even though the men under him fought the war. So Brahma must be regarded as a kind of leader. He is the pushing of individuality and personality into its ultimate. Here we have Nietzsche's Superman. Here we have the entire philosophy of Schopenhauer, and leading finally to the production of what might be called the extraordinary human type, the bravest, the strongest, the wisest of men. And here we have the leader who by karma is born to leadership again, but who is still bound by karma. Here we have the leader whose virtues can produce for him continual accumulation, as it is expressed in the great Buddha Sutra of the Benevolent King. Regardless of the fact that this leadership has created great and good karma, if the if he becomes selfish, he will create evil karma. He is still subject to the laws of cause and effect. If Brahma should compromise his principles, he would fall into the most horrible desolation. He is not superior to law. He is merely a being that represents to us in our minds and thinking the superior person, the one perhaps who we can think of as the world king, the great physicist, the great musician, or the great artist. As long as the individual remains humble and realizes that in the presence of infinite wisdom he is nothing, so long as wisdom increases, his influence grows, and his constructive usefulness multiplies. But the moment he says to himself, I am great, the moment a Napoleonic or Messianic complex arises in him, and the moment this superior person says, I am God, or I no longer need God, then his usefulness ends. According to Buddhism, this being is then cast downward into the sphere of delusion and must begin again on his evolutionary ascent. The Deva kingdom then represents the Superman, the superhuman being, the demigod of the Greeks, the human being that has risen to universal power, but who is still a human being living in the mortal world. He is capable of both good and evil, capable of corrupting his own career, and capable of endangering the world. This is the realm which the Buddhists try desperately to avoid. This is the realm that Zen has rejected. This is the realm that the Taoist monks of China rejected because they feel, and perhaps wisely, that any individual who becomes important loses sight of his own fallibility. He loses sight of his own power to make mistakes, and slowly but inevitably tyranny creeps in. Authority has given him the power to be cruel. Authority has given the power to break rules with impunity. But whenever a superior brings breaks bonds of trust with man, he breaks faith with universal law and projects himself into tragedy. The superior being is not free from the wheel of life, nor from the world of cause and effect. The Deva represent states of consciousness in which always self is present. Self is present as the great punisher in the lower regions of Hades. Self is present as the great danger in the higher regions. It was the turning of the wheel which carried the individual, according to his karma, from one region to another, and the wheel turns on the axis of the mind. Wherever his thoughts are, this he will be. Wherever his thoughts go, there he will be. This was the completion of the wheel in the Tibetan grouping. To the above are added four superior states or conditions in the mandala we have been describing, and these conditions also belong in a sense of mind. These superior states were represented by a series of specialized images. They are the disciples going on their way to enlightenment. One is called the non-embodying Buddha. This is the being who attains liberation, primarily for self. Among this, we have the Mahayana Bodhisattva, or the or the compassionate being. At the very summit of the entire cycle, we have the Buddha himself. And technically and actually, the only released being is a Buddha. All others are still to some degree tied to the realm of mental phenomena. We see how the soul moves upward from the realm of the lost souls to the realm of the hungry ghosts, from the hungry ghosts to the realm of the animals, and from the realm of the animals to the realm of men, and from the realm of men to the realm of the devas. This constitutes the first part of the cycle. Only above this part of the cycle do we begin the achievements of the higher parts of braces, or rather higher parts of branches of the wisdom philosophy. The first step on the way is symbolized by the disciple, the learner, the beginner, who starts forth on his journey to truth. The disciple represents one who is breaking with the entire concept of worldliness and is therefore ultimately going to excel the devas and the princes of this world. The disciple is one who is beginning to sublimate action, personalized purpose, and who is gradually overcoming all manifestations which bind consciousness to matter. As a meditating figure in a circle of activity, this disciple rests quietly. He is beginning to break the cycle of the wheel or samsara. He knows that he cannot escape by an evasion or avoidance. The only way in which he can escape from the net of mind is to transcend it. Gradually, in which he can escape from the net of mind, or gradually, he is beginning to liberate himself from the absolute authority of his own thinking. Gradually, he is trying to undermine his faith in his own ego, realizing that his faith binds him continuously and forever to the cycles of his own mistakes. The person who believes only in himself, or who believes that he is always right, must suffer. The disciple, therefore, attempts to break down his identification. He is determined not to permit his own ego or his own mind to affect him as though it were infallible. The fallibility of self is the beginning of that humility which is, of course, considered to be essential to all sanctification. In every religion of the world, humility is taught. Humility is detachment from self-esteem. Self-esteem can go no further than produce a Brahma or an Indra. It can produce only that being whose good karma elevates him, but whose mistake in high places casts him down again. And the disciple tries to escape from this pattern of consequences. Having passed to the level of humility, the power to recognize other values as greater than self, a power of continued dedication to law, principles, truth, life, and love, the disciple passes to the arhat state, and the arhat rather was called the worthy one. So this is a form of ascension. This is how the Buddhas and the yogas and the initiates began and learned and found nirvana. The Southern school of Buddhism considers the arhat to be the absolute dedicated truth seeker. The arhat in this school is the monastic unworldly person who has renounced all material considerations for the achievement of inner liberation from material existence. In the Southern school, the killing out of existence has been the great problem. It is the problem of completely emancipating the individual from every condition of his own consciousness. It is the dying out of every fire, every intensity, and the gradual sublimation of every perception and reflective power until the mind, the ego, the personal self goes to sleep in a complete samadhi, or detachment from all worldly conscious existences. This was the Arhat in the Southern School, or the Worthy One. The Northern followers of Buddhism, in its great crossing of Asia, felt that the Southern concept of Arhat state was incomplete. They felt very much as do a great number of religious leaders today, that an arbitrary control has been placed. In a sense, they felt isolated. They had become useless in their own world. Extreme austerity for the grace of God was not attractive to the Northern Buddhists. He felt that something was missing. It seemed to him that the Southern Arhat was selfishly leaving the world to suffer while he made his own single and solitary journey to the infinite. Even if he achieved his goal, he was leaving behind a world of pain. Surely, if the Arhat deserved enlightenment or liberation and had earned it by his own karma, he would attain it. If he had so lived with worldliness, had died out in him, if he had so lived that worldliness had died out in him, it would die out. The Northern School felt that something more was really right and proper, and that there was more to existence than this desperate effort to be enlightened. To a certain measure, this understanding has affected mystics and religionists all over the world. So many times, individuals in their desperate effort to grow neglect their responsibilities to others. They feel that to depart from life in some solitary state is justified for them, whereas for some other person it would be an escape from reality. And that's so true. You know, that's so true. We still have a responsibility to this world that we're from. And even though we want to escape from reality to the next dimension, we still owe it to our families, we owe it to our friends, we owe it to our society, for them to know how we get there, or where we are, or we should leave something for them, a trail or some kind of knowledge, so that they can find where we went, or they can be enlightened as well. So the Northern School changed the Arhat concept and made the Arhat a servant of truth. Testing in this world caused him to grow and unfold. At the same time, it transmuted his previous worldliness into an unworldly dedication to good. The Arhat in the Northern School became the worker, the individual whose duty it was to share with life all the growth that he had obtained. The Arhat became the instructor, the hands and feet of the Enlightened One, carrying forth the message to all parts of the world, passing through martyrdom, if necessary, and serving quietly and obscurely throughout his life. Within the Arhat was the sense of a divine realization. His purpose was a dedication to infinite truth and infinite love. So the Northern Arhat became a much more interesting and dramatic personality, one leading to a very much more interesting phase in philosophical insight. As the Southern Arhat might theoretically and ultimately attain a state of Buddhahood, which would be like Christhood, the next department on the wheel was the Buddha of the Southern School. This was regarded by the Northern Buddha School again as a distinct state, a state that was extremely extraordinary, subject to great veneration, and certainly worthy of the respect of all living things. But in some way, certainly not quite equal to their concepts of Buddhahood. The Buddha of the Southern School, therefore, was the sitting, meditating, extinct being, the being that had extinguished itself, that being that had attained eternal peace, eternal tranquility, and eternal freedom by eliminating the existence of self. This was the end of the path for the Southern Arhat. But casting off worldliness, by casting off self, by casting off mind, by casting off all manifestations of consciousness, until nothing remained, the flame went out. The fire had vanished forever. The individual who had completely ceased because of the extinction of all conditioned consciousness within himself was regarded as a Buddha according to the Southern School. This Buddha had returned to space and the place, where he had been known, where no one knew him anymore. The Buddha had returned to a space and the place where he had been knew. It's misspelled. All manifestation ceased, and where he has been, there was nothing but an eternal quietude. This, in a sense, was the goal or the end of the Southern School. So the end of the school was, you know, you went to the, once you achieved non-existence, you achieved nirvana. And, you know, you were at the height of selflessness. Because missionaries, wanderers, and travelers from Europe first contacted Buddhism through the Southern School, the idea that Buddhism was annihilation finally gained prominence in the West. This was an attractive idea for those of other faiths because it provided a point of difference which the missionary might argue the superiority of his faith. Had the Northern School dominated, there would have been almost no chance of any missionary work from foreign religions, but with this annihilation in an infant concept, the possibilities of referring to these people as the poor heathen loomed large in the minds of Western missionaries. It might even appear that Buddha himself taught this kind of liberation, but a deeper understanding of the philosophy confirms that Buddha was not talking about extinction. He was talking about a sublimation that carried the individual beyond this world. This was another realm, still a realm of the mind, for it was the mind that caused the individual to believe that he couldn't be, that he could be extinct. His extinction existed only as a mental phenomenon in himself. In other words, it is like a man saying, "I am not here," and believing it. The extinction problem simply is the mind assuming that that extinction is real and desperately attempting to maintain self-extinction. In the course of time, according to the Northern way of thinking, these extinct beings must awaken to the fact that their nirvana was only a mental development within themselves. It was an attitude. It was a kind of heaven that they had fashioned with their own vision. By means of the mind, they had tried to escape from mind. Actually, they were still there, only the mind was telling them that they no longer existed. Fascinating. But opposite the Buddha of the Southern School in the Ten Regions Mandala is the Bodhisattva, which usually embodied in Kanon. Kanon in Northern Buddhism is a symbol for a principle which is comparatively absent in the Southern School. We now have about 26 minutes remaining for those of you who are listening, and I'm going to continue this. I only have, I believe, one more page or so, one or two more pages, so you can pick it up in the archives. I want to thank everybody for listening tonight, and please continue with us in the archives, or you can call in right now to the show and hear the remainder of it. So thank you, and have a pleasant evening. And we are going to continue this reading right here, and it'll be in the archive. All right. Opposite the Buddha of the Southern School in the Ten Region Mandala is the Bodhisattva, usually embodied in canon. Canon in the Northern, I already read this. Sometimes the Lord Basatsu is included, but usually there is no point or place for the concept of Bodhisattva, as a thing of consciousness. And of course, this is a clue to the significance of canon. Canon, K-A-N-N-O-N, is a symbol of the ninth region of the mind, the realm or point of mental development in which the mind turns from all other considerations except the responsibility of universal benevolence. Canon is that instinct of the individual to live only for the common good. Therefore, canon represents the universal benefactor. It is the experience of consciousness as love. It is experience also of the transcendence problem of responsibility and duty. The Bodhisattva, according to the Northern system, has had the opportunities to break away from the circle of the wheel. He has been given by merit and virtue the privilege of passing on to become one of those extinct Buddhas. But choosing rather not to escape, he has remained under the law of karma voluntarily. While it is under the law of karma, even though it is so enlightened, it must continue to function according to karma. Therefore, it still has responsibility and is still capable of suffering. The bodhisattva consciousness is not something that the individual possesses. The bodhisattva is a level of consciousness. Therefore, it is a level of consciousness. Therefore, the personality may not even be aware that he has possessed this consciousness. He gains no personal satisfaction from it. Bodhisattva is reborn as the servant by his own will and dedication, but born as the servant, he is born unenlightened, and he must gradually redeem or release his enlightenment through conduct in his embodied state. The bodhisattva, therefore, is not one who knows his ministry from birth, but rather is one whose inner instincts of consciousness are such that he inevitably fulfills the bodhisattva requirement. This requirement basically is compassion or great benevolence in relation to every creature that exists, and the immediate and instinctive quality is sacrifice of self, life, and enlightenment for the advancement of all beings. Therefore, it was said in the old way that the bodhisattva might incarnate in any kingdom of nature and in any race. The bodhisattvas in their incarnations in the various kingdoms of nature take upon themselves the experience of these kingdoms, living according to the level and with no conscious knowledge of being different. The difference being present in the fact that they instinctively provide leadership. There is a strange deep guidance which is given to these creatures by the bodhisattva consciousness. In the human world, the bodhisattva becomes the symbol of spiritual guidance, absolute self-sacrifice, absolute dedication to principle, and absolute service to law. In the Buddhist system, no spiritual attainment causes the individual to be immune to the problems of physical life, and the bodhisattva will be subject to death in a physical sense the same as any other person. The bodhisattva are not only subject to these problems, but they must use these problems in turn as ways of instructing others in the true meaning of the doctrine. Therefore, they may appear in any realm or any world or in any one of the nine lesser conditions of existence. In these realms, they provide certain leadership, bestowing care, thought, and insight in giving a degree of benevolence to any condition which might otherwise seem strangely desperate and destitute. It was the teaching that in every realm they should take on the appearance and qualities of that realm, teaching the beings there in their own language and in their own terms and according to their own enlightenment. And I'm drawn to think of Thoth, actually, or Hermes. And we've spoken about him before on the Emerald Tablets and his mission to mankind over the many centuries. And he is, it appears that he is in that bodhisattva state of mind, even though he's an Atlantean and so on. But it appears that there may be true. At the very summit of the great circle sits the Buddha. Um, Thus, the Bodhisattva becomes the northern hemisphere, the symbol of the perfectly enlightened being, no longer resembling in any way the Brahma or Indra of the divine, of the Deva kingdom, no longer representing the extinct Buddhas of the southern Buddhist school, but more completely a great messianic being, a universal benefactor, a being that has forgotten self in the determined effort to bring all beings into an understanding and perfection with universal law. This would represent the highest degree of inter-individual exertion. At the very summit of the great circle sits the Buddha in meditation. He is a symbol of the final enlightenment and the final perfection of all things. In Mahayana Buddhism, the Buddhas themselves are not considered as being separate from life as they are in the southern system. Why? Because Mahayana has made this mystery of the mind truly a universal concept. To the Mahayanist, a Buddha is an experience within man himself. It is not a piece, it is not a being in space, but a quality of insight potential in man. When the individual being, the personal being, comes to a full and complete insight as the infinite purpose for himself and of all that lives, he comes to infinite peace, because purpose is infinite good. And the being that possesses full sight insight can have no fear, worry, or anxiety concerning the enlightenment of mankind. The Buddha, therefore, becomes a symbol of complete transcendence in the northern system. It represents the completeness, the final experience by the human mind of the universe as absolute benevolence. It is the universe moving in its infinite good, infinitely diversified and infinitely diffused. It represents consciousness as the acceptance of reality. It is a reality enthroned in the midst of manifestations of itself, forever impelling and inspiring the truth seeker to come nearer and nearer his state of reality. Almost all Buddhist images that we now find in either the southern or northern schools are derived from the imaginary likeness of the historical Buddha, or Gautama Siddhartha, who lived about 550 BC. His mission and ministry became the basis of modern Buddhism. And it is known in the world today. The Buddha himself pointed out that the final attainment of Buddhahood is possible only in the final exhaustion of karma. Even after his enlightenment, after he had become the Buddha, he was not actually free from karma. He was not free from the law until the last vestige of the unlawfulness had failed within himself. The final consummation of his karma was the eating of the tainted food. He paid his last debt to the past and paid it with his life. He told his disciples that this was the way it was. It was in this particular action in which he accepted tainted food that he met the last of the old debts that remained. And from that point on, there was nothing in his own nature that was left undone, nothing unfinished or unmended, all things having been completed and no new karma having been created. The being ceased as conditioned process. Being ceases as a conditioned process. The continuance of life or being, the continuance of karma creating personalities, the process having ceased, there would be no longer any involvement in material things. But this did not, however, to the northern Buddhists signify extinction. Instead of assuming, as we are inclined to do, that if we could ever accomplish anything like this cessation of karma, we would be truly divine. Well, the northern Buddhists take the attitude that when we have accomplished all of this, including Buddhahood, we have only become human. This is it. Our humanity is tied to the mind. Man is the creature of manas, the thinker. Therefore, the entire mystery of this existence is a mystery in and of mind. Man begins as a tiny, feeble little creature under the tyranny of an unfolding faculty. He goes along under the tyranny of mind until he passes through the 10 conditions which mind sets up. Having gradually outgrown one condition after another of mind, he finally brings mind to its highest possible projection, that we might say of the bodhisattva. Having therefore completed the use and power of mind and having absorbed into the consciousness all that mind had to teach, mind becomes completely subliminated. Mind becomes universal. Mind becomes impersonal and is completely non-karmic. We may say, therefore, that it has become non-toxic. It is no longer capable of producing sorrow. Having reached this degree of mental development, the mind no longer creates karma. Karma no longer creates continual personalities. And the process of personalization by re-embodiment ceases. It ceases because there is no person necessarily any longer. There is no unfinished business, and if there is no unfinished business, there is no person, to finish it. Having achieved to this point, mind that becomes bodhi of its own qualities and its own attributes. Thus, the Buddha becomes the symbol of the mind that has finished its labor of becoming, and having become the mind, is capable of projecting impersonally, unselfishly, and without limitation or restriction into a superior state. It was then only through the completion of the mind and removal of it as an impediment that the man can progress to the higher dimensions of consciousness. Man is bound here by the mind, and the mind is built a prison of 10 realms. Man is therefore, according to one of the old Buddhist fables, caught in a burning house. This burning house is the structure of his own desires. The only thing that can rescue him is the cessation of desire or peace, a symbol of complete freedom from conditioned existences. For practical purposes here, now and everywhere, we can say that this symbol of these 10 worlds represents the various ways in which we can estimate our own character. And having estimated our own character, we can best. Here, I got one last page stuck together. Determine what our motives are. To the Northern School, all motives and all growth processes are finally consummated in the Bodhisattva ideal. This Bodhisattva ideal is disseminated through all the 9 inferior worlds, is included or contained within the 10th, which is the life of the Buddha itself, which is Christhood, or full ascension. So, compassion is dominant as the controlling and redeeming factor in the 9 regions of conditioned existence, and itself leads the way to the 10th, or unconditioned state. We can look around and judge ourselves a little better by these things. Considering our inner natures, we can ask, do I secretly wish that I was the world king? Do I secretly wish for what my neighbor possesses? Do I wish to impose my thinking on other people? Am I willing to sacrifice my principles for temporal advantage? Am I willing to die physically rather than break a bad habit? Our answers tell us on which one of these 10 worlds we live. They also tell us that we can never escape from these worlds or their pains until we outgrow the negative and destructive attitudes that bind us there. Every one of the conditioned states, all the way up to Bodhisattva itself, if perverted or abused or in any way corrupted, casts its karmic shadow upon the light. It casts upon the individual the unfinished business of further self-redemption. The person who is gradually able to take on his own identity, or rather his own destiny, who strives to correct his own faults so that he can pass from one sphere to another can be, in a sense, rescued from any conditioned existence in which he finds himself. In every sphere of conditioned existence, we have the presence of the Canon Bodhisattva, or the Jizu Bodhisattva, symbols of light concealed in darkness. For in no matter what state we are in, no matter what condition we have fallen into, no matter what our pains may be, or our corruption and compromise, if we are still quiet and at peace and ask in our heart for guidance, we will find that in every one of these realms, the radiant power of compassion and kindness are ever present. All that the individual has to do is to behave wisely and lovingly where he is, and the dark path that is ahead of him that he does not understand will be marked. As it is said in the old books, when the individual, even in the deepest world of darkness, resolves to path opens. A lotus. As he walks, a lotus flower grows under each step so that he can never fall again in the darkness. What we learn from this interesting allegory and symbol is that we live not in one world, but many, and that in every region the impulse to goodness, the impulse to compassion, to love, to kindness, to friendship, to integrity exists. But the gradual redemption of ourselves, by the gradual redemption of ourselves, we escape from hells or infernos, or we even escape from the paradiso of the higher spheres. We escape from every conditioned existence until finally escaping from mind itself. We then, and then only, have the power to face reality without the conditioned attitude of our own thinking. I think that studied allegorically and symbolically in these terms, there are many very interesting points in this mandala of the Northern School well worth pondering upon, and a great spiritual and psychological significance. And that ends the lecture, and that ends the work, and that was the 10 regions on the afterlife, according to the teachings of Northern Buddhism by Manly Hall. And I hope you enjoyed that. It took a while to read it, a little dry here. If anybody's followed any of the work we've done previously regarding this, not just Manly, but on ascension consciousness and the like, and Christhood and so on, so Christ consciousness, rather. This is basically the same concept, basically the same story, that we live to serve. We live to serve mankind, and once we live to serve a purpose, whatever that purpose may be, in this life. And the struggle in our life is trying to find our purpose in life, and whatever that may be, whatever will make us happy in a career or in a marriage or simply in life. So all in all, our search, I'm grateful to have these works to read, and clarify some of the mysteries, especially in the Buddhism and, in so many, many others, so many other cultures. On that tone, or on that note, I would like to end the show tonight. And tomorrow night, George Dixon will be talking about fractal consciousness. And I am anxious to talk to him about that, because fractal consciousness, from what he stated, is like quantum physics, in that our quantum state, we can be in multiple places at one time, and talks about our existence. And And interestingly enough, it ties in a bit with these 10 regions, because these 10 regions are no different than what we had talked about possibly the 12 dimensions and the overtones and so on and so forth. But it seems like each division, each religion, copies from each other, and really do, as I mentioned in the last essay that we had, was Jesus Wept last week. We mentioned the allegorical aspects of all the religions, all major religions, and how they play on one another. And I brought about the concept of Job and the concepts of others in this particular, though that's Hebrew and this is Buddhists and Christian, and I mean it's all just one big pathway based on cultures, based on language, but it all seems to get to the same place. And at that, I'll leave you. And I thank you, and I wish you a good evening. Thanks for joining.